Yes, it is a wonderful book. We're going to look at Luke 24, those first 12 verses. The Bible is packed, it's just teeming with stories. I suppose that's why as a little boy I liked the Bible, because it was taught to me and there were so many stories. I read the book of another faith some time ago, read it right through from beginning to end, and at the end somebody said to me, "What do you think of that book?" I said, "I can only tell you, having read that book, I love the Bible. The Bible is packed with stories, and then stories about such a person. How can he ever be paralleled?" So this is Easter Sunday, everybody, and as we're looking at Luke chapter 24, those first 12 verses, I'd like to pick out first of all verses 5 and 6. "In their fright, the women bowed down with their faces to the ground, but the angelic men said to them, 'Why do you look for the living among the dead? He is not here, he's risen. Remember how he told you while he was still with you in Galilee, the Son of Man must be delivered into the hands of sinful men, be crucified, and on the third day be raised again.' Then they remembered his words." The former Archbishop of Canterbury, Michael Ramsay, was once being interviewed on the air by David Frost. It always seems to be David Frost who did those interviews years ago. And he said to Archbishop Ramsay, "If I could bring the bones of Jesus Christ into this television studio, what would it do to your faith? I wonder how you'd answer." I thought the Archbishop gave a wonderful answer. He said, "Because your question is completely hypothetical and without any foundation whatever, I refuse to answer the question." David Foster said, "But I know it's hypothetical, but I'm only saying if I was able to bring the bones of Jesus Christ into this studio, what would it do to your faith? What would you say?" I refused to answer the question. Next question, and they went on to another question. I thought that was exactly right. If somebody told me, "I'm just off to the Middle East to find the bones of Jesus Christ," I suppose I would say to them, "God bless you, my boy. Have a good time. I'll remember you. I'm full of optimism that you're going to be greatly helped." Because I'm sure that so many people who've done that kind of errand, gone on that kind of quest, to come back changed people, and they find the opposite of what they have so far thought might be the situation. They come back convinced in the resurrection of Christ. So if somebody told me that, I'd say, "Go, you go. Have a good time, I'll remember you. Tell me how you got on." There's every hope for the man or woman, boy or girl, who's prepared at least to investigate, to contemplate the life-changing implications, the completely different universe that's facing us in the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Oh, it makes a difference. Here in this passage of Luke 24, which glows for us, are an unspecified number of women who, even before the first light of Sunday morning in Jerusalem, are well prepared with their plan of action. That first sentence here speaks of deliberation, of forethought and preparation. We're on page 1061. I hope you've got it open in front of you. "On the first day of the week, very early in the morning, the women took the spices they had prepared and went to the tomb." Then, in the space of, I suppose, 1 minute, their whole day was thrown into confusion. It started with the empty tomb, verse 2, and if there's something on which every serious contributor to the discussion is agreed, it is that the tomb was empty. It continued, with the angelic messengers, verses 4 and 5, and all four gospel writers are agreed on there being an angelic presence by the tomb that morning, Matthew and Mark identifying the spokesman alone, Luke and John acknowledging that there was in fact a pair of angelic messengers. Their day, it turned on the reminder to the women, verse 6, of Christ's earlier prediction that he would be put to death only to rise again. It culminated in the group's retracing of their steps, verse 9, to dig the 11 disciples out of their beds and gasp out a story which, apart from Peter and John, whose action is reported elsewhere, is met by flat disbelief. It was a day of disruption for them all. The four different gospel writers fill in the picture for us, and how grateful we are for the four gospels. See, if you put all four reports together, we get a picture of confusion, excitement, of people running, sometimes one party just missing another, almost like a Victorian farce. You have to be careful as you look at the four different Gospels. There are some who get anxious about the little differences in reporting between the four Gospels. But there's a harmony there. You've only got to take out a bit of pencil and paper, work it out. You can work it out in half an hour, what the harmony is. Shall I tell you how it worked out? As far as I can understand as a Bible student, early on Sunday, the resurrection of Jesus Christ takes place. It's marked by an earthquake. An angel descends and rolls away the stone from the tomb. That's Matthew 28, verses 2 to 4. And then the demoralized soldiers disperse into the city. Matthew 28, verse 11. Later, to the tomb comes Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome. Another group of women follow with the spices. Mary Magdalene arrives first, John 20, verses 1 and 2, sees that the tomb is open, and immediately rushes to inform Peter and John. The other Mary and Salome, on reaching the tomb, see the angel, Matthew 28, verse 5. They're told to tell the news to the disciples. They go. Then the other women, including Joanna, approach. They see two angelic figures and are reminded by them that Jesus had predicted his own resurrection, Luke 24, 1-7. Meanwhile, Mary Magdalene has alerted Peter and John, and they set off for the tomb, John 20, 3 and 4, running, with Mary following behind. By the time Mary has arrived, Peter and John have already been into the tomb and have gone, John 20, verse 10. And Mary stays weeping at the tomb, John 20, verse 11. Then sees the two angels, who ask her why she weeps. It's then that she has her encounter with the risen Lord Jesus Christ, John 20, verse 14. While this is happening, the other women have seen the rest of the disciples and told them of the events which are regarded as an idle tale, Luke 24, verse 11. It's probably them, on their way back to the tomb, that Jesus meets them on the way, Matthew 28, verse 9, and they worship him. Sometime later that day, the risen Christ meets with Peter alone, Luke 24, verse 34, and 1 Corinthians 15, verse 5. Also, he meets with the two travelers to Emmaus, Luke 24, 13 to 35. And then later still, with the entire group of disciples, excepting Thomas, Luke 24, 36 to 43. John 20, 19 to 25. Just get a bit of paper and pencil, you can work it out. The breathlessness of events that day. A tremendously confusing day. You've probably had the experience, have you not, ladies and gentlemen, of starting out on a day with your own set plan. You've got it all in your diary. Only for the whole thing to be disrupted because of one unforeseen incident. I'm sure you've had that happen to you. So it was here. The Easter event meant and means that one, the program has to change. The group of women who had stuck by Jesus in everything got up on that morning prepared to perform one last small service for their friend. It wasn't even the main bit. That had been done on Friday by Joseph of Arimathea and by Nicodemus, the placing of the body in the tomb. But in the haste of that evening on Friday, with the Jewish Sabbath right on top of them, there was a limit as to how much could be done. And the women then had their plan to get up early, once the Sabbath is over, and complete these last sacred funeral rites as a loving action. That's the program. Then they find the tomb empty. In 1 minute, the whole thing has to be scrapped. Okay, let me put it to you. Have you ever come in at what you think is one part of the program, you find actually it's another part altogether? You come in at what you think is the beginning of the program, and actually you've arrived at the very, very end with people streaming out. I did that for a wedding once. I was taking the wedding. Arrived, and there they were pouring out. Somebody that somehow, they miraculously found another clergyman. I had arrived 1 hour late. Appalling. Here it's the other way around. Here it's the other way around completely. They thought that they were at the tail end of the film. No, they're not. The show has just started. So forget those spices. Why do you seek the living among the dead? Verse 5. So, change your program at once. That was the message of the day. You've come to be undertakers, you women. Now you've got to leave as evangelists. What C.S. Lewis once called a new chapter in cosmic history has opened. So here was a person, a leader, fully God and fully man, representative and head of a new community, that's us, who hadn't simply pushed death back by a few more years. Not at all. He'd actually transcended it. It had already, you know, been wonderful enough in the gospel story, with people like Jairus' daughter, aged 12, being raised from death, and Lazarus, who'd been raised to life after being 4 days in the grave. But you see, I mean, Jairus' daughter and Lazarus would die again one day. Look at Lazarus. Can you see the picture? Him tottering out of the tomb, swathed round with the bandages. And Jesus had commanded him, Lazarus, come forth. Out he comes. He's looking at it in a terrible state. Unbind him, said Jesus, and let him go. Go? Go where? Why, back to the house in Bethany. It'll be lunchtime soon. Martha and Mary, his sisters. And then let's just look at the washing up rotor, Lazarus. Oh, it's your turn today. You don't mind, do you? You were here in time to do it. Oh, and Lazarus, the tax man's coming tomorrow. Have you filled in your returns yet? Must make sure you've got it ready for the tax man. Do you see? The raising of Lazarus was a wonderful thing, but Lazarus had been brought back into the old decaying world with its aches and pains, its chores, its headaches, and one day he was going to go through the whole process all over again. No, the raising of Lazarus was like the bee film. It was the curtain raiser to the big thing, the resurrection of Jesus Christ, transcending death itself. The raising of Lazarus wouldn't change any program. The resurrection of Jesus Christ necessitates a complete reordering of life and its priorities. Has it done it for you? For me? Death is still an enemy, but the followers and friends of Jesus everywhere have to see this life as the bee film, as the pale shadow of the vitality and color of the resurrection life that transcends death. And if our daily program down here isn't affected by the Christian truth of Jesus Christ alive forever, then I suppose we ought to question whether we know Jesus really. I remember seeing Michael Parkinson, the TV interviewer some years ago, interviewing a very prominent man on television, very prominent indeed. At the end of an extraordinarily interesting interview, he posed his final question. He said, "You're an old man now. How do you view the approach of death? What lies ahead for you?" I leant forward to listen to the answer. What was this wise man going to say? Oh, said the eminent personage, I expect I'll probably get along all right, take my chances, I'll, you know, muddle through. I thought, that man has not given 10 minutes thought to his program for eternity. With all that he knows about this life, has he nothing to say? No viewpoint at all about life beyond? Nothing? All that we had was a string of fatuous platitudes at the end of all the earlier wisdom and experience exhibited in the interview. The program has to change, has to be affected. It did for those women. It did for those disciples. We can't go on living as people geared to retirement and a cozy little house at the end if we are children of the resurrection. The program has to change. It is a thrill when we hear of somebody who has been sent by God into some difficult part of the world from this congregation, as we were praying for 3 of our members tonight. And they're going not to the easiest places in the world, they're going to extremely difficult places in the world. What impelled them? It has something to do with the resurrection. Christ is the risen Lord. He has commissioned them. The program has to change. Their program changed. Secondly, the thinking has to change. The mindset. So verse 5, why do you seek for the living among the dead? And then verse 6, remember, he says, how Jesus told you while he was still with you in Galilee, the Son of Man must be delivered into the hands of sinful men, be crucified, on the third day be raised again. Then they remembered his words. And that, I suppose, is the way in which so many think who've come into contact with Jesus Christ. They've remembered, it's been brought home to them. Their whole framework of thinking begins to change. But for many, it doesn't make any impact at all. It hasn't made any impact yet. They make plans for death, maybe even, but no further. An undertaker I knew once confided to me that a certain client wrote, making advance plans for his own future funeral, and ended his letter with the words, "Yours eventually." Well, that sounds like real resignation. And I suppose there are many who do think in that way. Death comes as the inevitable end. There's nothing which we can garrison ourselves against it with. And so let's resign ourselves. Maybe it was so for these companions of Jesus. I'm sure it was. Despite all his earlier predictions, as the angels remind the women in verse 6, their mindset couldn't actually take it in. They heard the words of Christ about his rising again, but the words didn't actually register. Of course, it had a tremendous amount to overcome. Think of the Greek world. Think of the old Jewish world. Think of the Roman world. The epitaphs on old tombstones and in ancient literature give it away repeatedly. There's a collection of books composed of epigrammatic poetry entitled The Greek Anthology. And death is invariably viewed with despair, cynicism, bitterness. I quote, "Child, be not overly distressed. I was not. I was born. I lived. I am not. That is all." Here's another quote. "All we are kept for death. All we are kept for death. Fed like a herd of swine that are butchered without rhyme or reason." Here's another. "Here lie I, Dionysius of Tarsus, 60 years old, unwed. Would that my father had been the same." Well, it's very different from what we now read in Paul's words of 1 Corinthians 15, where it's a taunt song. "Death, what do you think you can do?" The New Testament shines with faith and confidence. Its message entered the tired thinking of the Greek world, challenged the decadent philosophy of the Roman world, looked carefully at the vague theology of the old Jewish world, and then superseded all of them together. Gone were the shadowy hopes of a great survival life beyond the grave. Gone was the vague thought of a postponement of the end. And, you know, even the hymns of many Christian people fail to match the ability of the New Testament in the writing there to laugh at death and challenge its powers. John Bunyan, even, such a great man, could only write of the icy waters through which the pilgrim must pass. Or we sometimes find ourselves singing of death's gloomy portals, of its sullen rolling stream. I prefer Paul. Death is swallowed up in victory. O death, where is thy victory? O grave, where is your sting? Thanks be to God who gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. It's a taunt song that the New Testament gives us. And that message of Easter transformed the thinking of millions from that group of women onwards. Life, history, is far from the endlessly recurring cycle of some Eastern faiths. You just go around in a cycle, you come back in some other form, hoping against hope it'll be better next time. It's far from the relentless domination of fate. It's far from a running down of powers and energies towards an inevitable annihilation. Life for the Christian is a matter of working up, in fact, a living out of life now with zest in the light and purpose of the resurrection and towards the consummation of all things in the new heaven and the new earth with Christ, the returning owner of all things, as he ushers in the new kingdom in superlative glory. Easter is an education. We have to teach ourselves this mindset. Are we doing that? If we don't, we will get sucked in by the deadening secular philosophy all around us. We will find ourselves saying, yes, well, of course, I must make all my plans for retirement and death. Well, that's quite right, of course. And then I must get ready for the fact I shall lose my powers and I won't be so vibrant, won't be so strong in spirit, running down of the system. Don't think like that. But we have to educate ourselves. It means taking in day by day from the scriptures. Day by day from the New Testament, from the words of Christ. What does he say? What is he, the great teacher of the world, saying? As we do that, then we shall find ourselves at the age of 60 plus, 70 plus, 80 plus, fresher, more vibrant, stronger, such is the testimony of Christian history, than we were even at 25 and 30. It takes an education. Easter is an education. Are we taking in from the scriptures? If not, we shall find that we atrophy. We shall start to get stuck in a rut at 30. You can be old at 25. The program has to change. The thinking has to change. Thirdly, the conviction has to change. Verses 10 and 11 help us here. Let me start at verse 9. When they came back from the tomb, they told all these things to the 11 and to all the others. It was Mary Magdalene, Joanna, Mary the mother of James, and the others with them who told this to the apostles. But they did not believe the women because their words seemed to them like nonsense. Peter, however, got up and ran to the tomb. Bending over, he saw the strips of linen lying by themselves, and he went away, wondering to himself what had happened. So obviously Luke later, when he got the chance of working it out as to what had happened to Peter, Peter doesn't bother to include a bit about running with John. He just includes a bit about himself in this particular report. And of course, as we know, it was John who saw and believed that something had happened. It's Peter who's left. What has happened? He's not quite sure. But the conviction has to change. The disciples on that Easter morning couldn't take it in. Their framework of thinking couldn't accept that their world, which on Friday had ground to an agonizing halt, with a Messiah dead and evil on top, with the sun extinguished, the whole thing had been reversed, and that the Galilean had the last laugh. It was almost too good to be true. Maybe they'd been through too much. So they were saying, in effect, please, women, oh, don't tantalize us now. It's too much, and after all, it's very early in the morning, and perhaps the early morning light was playing tricks on you. It took a little while, but the conviction changed. There's no story of wishful thinking in the New Testament report of the resurrection, as some critics would maintain. Here's no story of hallucinations either, because this pattern of hallucination is that it's very individualistic. You don't get 500 people at once seeing the same hallucination, the same fantasy, dreaming dreams or seeing visions. And people who do have hallucinations or who dream dreams or who see visions keep on having them. In this case of Jesus, the appearances ceased as abruptly as they'd begun once the ascension took place. And as it dawned upon those early friends of Jesus that it really was true, visibly, bodily, raised from death, and as they remembered his words of prediction about the Son of Man rising from the dead, they thought, yes, that ties in with the prophecies too. Their view of life upon this world became transformed. Conviction took over. Yes, Christian leaders may indeed concern themselves with the details and issue of daily living and of society and with the problems surrounding our gross national products, supplementary benefit, housing quotas, social security and the like. I know we have to live with those things. But the bigger thing altogether, as far as the early church was concerned, was even at the expense of letting issues like slavery be dealt with later, to make known the revelation of God's saving action, Jesus Christ. Because once a whole society can comprehend the greater canvas, the radically different outlook that takes in heaven and hell, Calvary and the resurrection and the lordship of Jesus the Messiah, the ripples from that will begin to affect the structures and the governmental systems and all. They certainly should. They certainly did in Europe. It isn't enough simply to subscribe to the truth of the resurrection with a casual nod to it as the creed comes round. On that basis, you can have 6 resurrections before breakfast. It won't change anybody. What's the conviction? There's a 19th century clergyman, an Anglican clergyman, who in his sermon on Good Friday referred to what he called the truly extraordinary behavior of Judas Iscariot. Well, that's no way to preach. The greatest people of history, who are they? Well, they are the conviction people who, by the force of their beliefs, change society and shape it with the energy that blazed from an encounter with the resurrection. And if we can only look back on the history of this nation, we can see that the church was here long before we were even a nation. And the people who made the most significant contributions to our heritage were those people of conviction. And in every case, they were undergirded with a view of life that had the faith of the New Testament as its framework. The program has got to change. The thinking has got to change. It's an education, Easter. We train ourselves in it, taking in what happened, what can we learn from it, what does it mean to my whole view of the universe and of my own life, my little candle flame of a life, what is it here for? What am I doing with my energies here on this planet? What is it all about? The program must change. The thinking must change. The conviction must change. I end with this Persian, some words from the Persian Easter hymn, written by Hasan Dekwani Tafti, a convert from Islam, who then became bishop in Iran. He experienced the assassination of his son. He survived a murderous attack on himself and his wife. This is what he said. Spread the news, look abroad, he has risen to reign. Now at last heaven is open to earth once again. Now that death's power is spent and is vanquished for aye, who should fear any storm, who now cringe in dismay. Lift your eyes to the hills. Greet the bright rising sun. Now our hearts and our souls are renewed all as one. See, the tomb is found bare. This the work of God's hand. See, our Jesus now risen. In this faith may we stand. Well, we will stand. Whatever's happening in our circumstances, we will stand as martyrs and others teach us from around the world, where their circumstances are so terrible at times. We will stand when the conviction has taken hold of us. He is alive forever. He is the controller and the ruler of everything. Whatever happens, besides that, nothing else matters.